Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, boy, I'll tell you what, they had foresight. And what they saw was potentials for what we are experiencing this very day. This is Tom Novolis, your host, and I'm delighted that you are back with me with this program. And today we are going to get into a topic that hasn't been discussed probably in several years, but is at the forefront of a number of emails that I've been receiving over the last week plus. And a lot of that has to do with the World Health Organization and a series of amendment changes to the World Health Organization, WHO's constitution in relationship to global pandemics and so on and so forth. Now, I have seen and looked at numerous articles from not only the Patriot media, if you will, but also comments by some congressmen out there. So what I thought I would do today is take the time to review with you treaties and international executive agreements, or better known as executive agreements. So in doing so, I would highly recommend that on the first order, if you would, but you most, I don't know if you will or not, but I would suggest that you go out and you could either go to the website, samueladamsreturns.net, and you could take and order my book from what? Covenant to the Present Constitution. You can also find that on Amazon, and you can order it on Amazon that way. But if you go to samueladamsreturns.net, and you send me an email, you can buy the book directly from me, and I'll even sign it for you if you wanted me to. But the reason I'm recommending that is not to sell books. I mean, I don't promote a lot of the various books or videos or any of that I have. Probably bad on me. That's why we don't get a lot of financial support here, except for the couple folks that do. But the reason that I wrote that book in particular was to take and help people understand that our Constitution is covenantal. It's not a societal, cultural, or any other type of pact or document in the way that so many others want to describe it. But no, it is a covenant. And that's first and foremost that you need to understand that, and that's what I bring out. But more importantly, what I want to do is talk about the chapter that I have there. It is on what of international executive agreements. I talk about treaties in the book as well, and I go through from the slide presentation that I have done on the book. And so this is all the way into slide 70, 69, 70, 71, when it comes to talking about treaties and international executive agreements, or better known as executive agreements. If you go to the references for this week's newsletter, again, it's samueladamsreturns.net, you'll see all the other documentation. I only put in like maybe 11 different references for this specific topic, because it is critical. And what's frustrating for me is once again that our political leaders, the Patriot news media, even congressmen have taken in, again, sensationalized and emotionalized this whole area around the World Health Organization and these changes that are in for proposal to amend their constitution. And you're going, World Health Organization has a constitution? Well, yes, it does. There's a references in there for you to take a look at, is that it is a part of the United Nations. It's chapter 9, I believe, in health on the various treaties in the United Nations, and we're signed on to it. So the first thing to understand is that we have a lot of treaties. And just to talk about that for a moment before I jump into the chapter on the book, I think it's critical for you to understand the foreign entanglements. So in one of the references that I have in Justia, JUSTIA.com, it's a law journal that I subscribe to, and that is that let's look at just the treaties alone. So the treaties during the first half century of independence, the United States was party to 60 treaties, but to only 27 published executive agreements. So right there were executive agreements that were going into effect in the first half century of this nation. Then, by the beginning of World War II, there had been concluded approximately 800 treaties and 1,200 executive agreements. Interesting. So executive agreements and treaties, and we'll get into what they are here in during the program, because quite frankly and honestly, just to make the point for you, executive agreements become the law of the land, no different than treaties. The only difference is they don't have to go through senatorial advice and consent. Some do. And we'll talk about the differences, because there's three different types of executive agreements that are out there and how they function and all of that. So you need to understand that. Then in the period between 1940 and 1989, the nation entered into 759 treaties and into 13,016 published executive agreements. Now you have to understand there are some secret executive agreements that are only titled, like the Yalta Agreement, which we don't know the full context of the Yalta Agreement that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, entered into with Stalin at that time. And some of that is still how we are playing out with Russia. Interesting. Now, cumulatively, in 1989, the United States was party to a total of about 890 treaties, and then another 5,117 executive agreements. So to phrase it comparatively, in the first 50 years of the history of the United States, concluded twice as many treaties as executive agreements. In the 50-year period from 1839 to 1889, executive agreements and treaties were concluded, almost twice as many executive agreements and treaties were concluded. Between 1939 and 1993, executive agreements compromised more than 90% of the international agreements concluded. And when you start looking at these in detail, you're sitting here going, what, how, what happened? How did it happen? How could it happen that we're in more executive agreements that do not require the Senate to participate? And why are we in the mess we're in? As far as foreign policy in particular, why are we seeing the erosion of our various liberties, or why are we seeing this internationalism occurring in different ways? maybe we need to go back to some of not just the treaties, but the executive agreements. So with that, and before we jump through all of it more, let me tell you that there is a link at SamuelAdamsReturns.net for today's program. And there I have the treaties in force right now. Now, that's about 570 pages of just the titles of the treaties and the executive agreements as well. So these are bilateral treaties and executive agreements. And for instance, when you go into it, here's one in particular. And you have to look at, and you have to go into the details to find out if any of these treaties, when do they sunset? And then what is the financial cost, the financial burden to the American people? About 10 years ago, I did start a spreadsheet of it. And quite frankly, it is hundreds of billions of dollars that we are on the hook for. Hundreds of billions, probably closer to a trillion now, especially with what's been going on, Afghanistan and all of that. But just to give you an example, and then we're going to get into the details of what these are all about in the second and third segment. But I want to hit you with the example that's not just the World Health Organization on these various areas. But let's look at Afghanistan and the debacle of Afghanistan alone. And what we're seeing here is that there are treaties on cultural exchange, property, and cooperation. Agreements relating to the exchange of official publications. Agreement concerning cultural relations. Agreement relating to the establishment of a Peace Corps program in Afghanistan. Now, when I start looking at these, I don't see a sunset for these agreements. So, in principle, these agreements are still treaty or agreements with Afghanistan. Defense. Here's the big one. Defense. Agreement relating to the deposit by Afghanistan of 10% of the value of grant military assistance furnished by the United States. Enduring strategic partnership agreement. It entered into force in what? July 4th of 2012, of all things. Acquisition agreement with annexes. Acquisition and cross-servicing agreement with annexes. Security and defense cooperation agreement with annexes. Agreement regarding the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 or successor legislation, including international military education and training. Peacekeeping operations, which we blew out of that, so this section may be defunct, but I have not seen anything new around it, and this went into effect in 2018, so that was during the Trump administration. So you know, you could do the homework and find out if that one got blown out. But here's a big one too, on finance in Afghanistan alone. Investment incentive agreement with an appendix, 2004. Agreement regarding the consolidation and rescheduling of debts owed to, guaranteed by, or insured by the United States government or its agencies, 2007. Agreement regarding the reduction of certain debts owed to, guaranteed by, or insured by the United States or its agencies. Agreement regarding reduction of certain debt owed to United States by the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. Then it goes into foreign assistance and on and on and on, just for Afghanistan. Ladies and gentlemen, George Washington said to be wary and not to get involved in international entanglements. There are so many that argued, oh, we needed to do these things. No, we did not. And we're going to go into the history of the executive agreements in particular in the next couple of segments. And it's going to shock some of you as to what happened back in the 50s. Come on back to next segment of Samuel Adams Returns, because the Anti-Federalists Got it right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this second segment of Samuel Adams Returns, Those Anti-Federalists Got It Right. I took you through some of an example of Afghanistan, the treaties, and different agreements in that first segment. But what I'd like to do now is take you back in history a bit in relationship to what are the executive agreements. And to do so, I'd just like to simply take you back to my book. And in there, I define it very simply in that international executive agreements, an executive agreement is an agreement between the United States and a foreign government that is less formal than a treaty and not subject to constitutional requirement for ratification by two-thirds of the U.S. Senate. The Constitution of the United States does not specifically give the president the power to conclude executive agreements. However, he may be authorized to do so by Congress, or he may do so on the basis of a power granted to him to conduct foreign relations. Despite the question about constitutionality of executive agreements, in 1937, the Supreme Court ruled that they had the same force as treaties. You have to understand that. Because executive agreements are made on the authority of the incumbent president, they do not necessarily bind his successor. So when we get into what did Pompeo do during the Trump administration to get us out of these entanglements? Very little. Very little. In fact, we entered into a whole bunch more agreements, executive agreements, let alone treaties. Let me continue here, because this is just simply out of the Encyclopedia Britannica that I put there into the book for you. Most executive agreements have been made pursuant to a treaty or to an act of Congress. Sometimes, however, presidents have concluded executive agreements to achieve purposes that would not command the support of two-thirds of the Senate. For example, after the breakout of World War II, before America's entry into the conflict, President Roosevelt negotiated an executive agreement that gave the United Kingdom 50 overage destroyers in exchange for a 99-year lease on certain British naval bases in the Atlantic. What a deal, huh? Let's see. So when we look at what it just said here by definition, let's go into what we get from the State Department Manual 11 FAM 721.2. There are two procedures under domestic law through which the United States becomes party to international agreement. First, international agreements, regardless of their title, designation, or form, whose entry into force with respect to the United States takes place only after two-thirds of the Senate has given its advice and consent under Article 2, Section 2. Two of the Constitution are treaties, so that's a treaty. Second, international agreements brought into force with respect to the United States on constitutional basis other than with the advice and consent of the Senate are international agreements other than treaties and are often referred to as executive agreements. There's a difference. So I've gone through this in detail. Now, in relationship to all the documentation that I have in here for you in these pages, and I'm actually giving you the pages, if you go to samueladamsreturns.net, there's a link to this section, and you can download the PDF in relationship to this. But what I wanted to take you to is something that Joe Biden was involved in and received information on when he was in the Senate as part of the 106th Congress, second session. there was a study group. It was prepared, and the title of it is Treaties and Other International Agreements, the Role of the United States Senate. So they're trying to define, the Senate asked the question, what is their role in dealing with treaties and international agreements? So this was prepared for the Committee on Foreign Relations of the United States Senate by the Congressional Research Service Library. Those that were on this committee at the time, the Jesse Helms was the chairperson. First name that's on the left-hand side is Joseph R. Biden. He received this report, which is like 379 pages, very historically laid out, very in-depth. And I'm going to take you through only a couple of it because ideas that are in here, because the question comes to what is it? And that Biden and his staff and the people in the legislature understand these and use them for their power mongering. And quite honestly, this will be a shock to my dad, is that Dwight D. Eisenhower is the one that stopped Congress from taking this power away from the presidency and keeping it in more control of the Congress. Eisenhower did this, and I'll talk about that within the next two segments. But let me get into this whole section on what this means without even going into all the details. But like, here is the historical background and growth of international agreements is on page 27 of this 379-page report. But when I drive on down to through the table of contents is very deep. It's about, let's see, 6 pages in itself. Is that the whole study was from a point that it's reporting on what does it mean for these international agreements into Congress. Now, treaties are serious, you know, and internationally, once they're enforced, treaties are binding on the parties and become part of international law. Now, domestically, treaties to which the United States are party are equivalent in status to federal legislation. That's why it says they become the law of the land. That's what the Constitution says. Treaties become law of the land. Now, what we also go through, and we need to understand very clear, is that under international law, treaties become effect immediately. In the United States, and that's what it means, is a treaty is international law. That's how internationals look at it. In the United States, the word treaty is reserved for an agreement that is made by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, international agreements not submitted to the Senate are known as executive agreements. In the United States, but are considered treaties and therefore binding under international law. You see, who's defining what they're all about? Many agreements, and we have to understand here, is that presidents have increasingly concluded, as we saw from the example that I mentioned earlier in the first program, how often they've been used. They continue to do that. Many agreements are previously authorized or specifically approved by legislation. And such congressional executive or statutory agreements have been treated almost interchangeably with treaties in several important court cases. Others, often referred to as sole executive agreements, are made pursuant to inherent powers claimed by the president under Article 2 of the Constitution. I explained that earlier as well. So neither the Senate nor Congress as a whole is involved in concluding the sole executive agreements, and their status is domestic law is not fully resolved. So it's real questionable. There's still debate out there, but there's no attorneys that really argue it to any extent as to if the president makes these agreements, international agreements in particular, that are they really binding on we the people? So the question on these the use of treaties, congressional executive agreements, and sole executive agreements underline many issues. Therefore, the study, this is the Senate role in a treaty, must also deal with executive agreements. Moreover, the President, the Senate, and the House of Representatives have different institutional interests at stake. Always, who's interested in what, for what reason? So in the House, what's their share? You know, the common share of interest in making international agreements that are in the national interest in most effect and efficient manner as possible. So that's what it should drive to. But from many international agreements that are not submitted for its content, you have to understand that. Let's see. Presidents have made important commitments that they consider politically binding but not legally binding. But somebody picks up on that. So let me give you one example that I use in the book in particular, is that what we have in Agenda 21, now Agenda 2030, now, you know, all this environmental wacko stuff that's going on, the Paris agreements and so on and so forth that were entered back into. You know, Trump, if he gets elected as president in 2024, can pull out of Paris again. Unfortunately, a lot of it's been codified, which happens way too often, as we're learning in this document and report alone. But Agenda 21 was signed on by who? The first, President Bush. Yeah, it was Republican President Bush that signed on to UN Agenda 21. I've spoken about that numerous times. And then it was Bill Clinton that put the first dollars to it in a study group. And then it was Nancy Pelosi as a young congresswoman that actually moved it forward for full funding. So you have to understand sustainability, Agenda 21 and all of this stuff was during the Bush one signing on to it as an executive agreement under the UN treaty. And then it got funded through Bill Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, and Congress has been funding it ever since. Wow. You see, this is the travesty. That's why in the newsletter, I call it the evil, because it's evil the way this has been used. Let me go through this document, just a couple more real quick things, is that the idea that the function of the Senate was to both to protect the rights of the states and to serve as a check against presidents taking excessive or undesirable actions through treaties. Should be that way also with the executive agreements. But a lot of times these guys sign on to stuff. Just think about it. Hey, you got McConnell's wife, whose father is intimately tied to financing that in the Communist Chinese Party. So where is the self-interest? Where is it to protect the states? And we well know that the Senate does not function to protect the states. That's a 17th Amendment thing that, you know, I won't get into today. So it gets to that point. Congress does not ratify treaties. The president does the ratification based on his signature. The Senate should participate in treaties. And you have to understand that if there's legislative or committee agreement within the Congress, the House, or the Senate towards an administrative agreement, you got to look at who you're electing, folks. What is going on there? Sam Adams knew that there would always be the potentials for this Constitution becoming what it has become because we don't have moral leadership anymore. I'll touch on that briefly in the next segment. But, you know, one of the things I want to leave you with is that, hey, America, we deserve what we are getting. And the bottom line is that is we're a sinful nation. And until we repent individually and as a nation, guess what? There is God's judgment. Once again, Sam Adams knew that. A number of the anti-federalists did as well. So come on back for the third segment as we close it out. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. And I would love to be able to have hours to talk to you about this. I do hope that somebody else will pick it up and be able to bring this to a greater national type of conversation, because what we have going on right now with this Ukrainian insanity, Russia, China, all of these components that are moving internationally are old news in so many different ways, but they're fresh because we have allowed it to happen. Our elected allowed it to happen. And quite frankly, we have given into abuses of power legally. By all means, legally, we have abuses of power. So we're seeing that the Biden administration, which is actually being run by Susan Rice, and remember who Susan Rice was under the Obama administration. And so we know that, you know, old Joe is just flowing with what it is that is going on from that direction. Even when we look at the whole thing on diversity, equity, inclusion, and all of that from its international basis, go look at what executive agreements have been signed on to. Look at how they're being funded by taxpayer dollars. Look at that process, and you understand that, you may or may not understand that the internationalism that everybody, at least those that understand constitutionalism, have been saying, whoa, time out, has been in place for over a century. Now, there are a number of the references that are there at SamuelAdamsReturns.net for today's program. And the one that goes back into the 40s is titled as "Shall the Executive Agreement Replace the Treaty?" Very interesting. You know, at that point in time, he was talking about here, just as a, once again, a kind of a summary of what we heard before, is that the advocates of a change point out of some 1,300 executive agreements have been concluded during our national history, as contrasted with some 900 treaties. It is not mentioned, however, that up until 1928, only 15 treaties had been rejected by the Senate, usually for good reasons, and 47 were not acted upon, and that while some 160 treaties have been amended by the Senate, in most cases the changes have benefited the nation. And then it goes on to talk about this. And this was written back in like 1941. And then there were further arguments in relationship to it. Questions about what are the separations of powers. Those links are there for you to read these documents. I mean, they average maybe 100 pages. But there was an argument to stop all of this, especially after World War II. As I mentioned in one of the last segments about the Yalta Agreement, that was agreement between FDR and at that time Stalin and that other fella there from England. Yeah, you know, the portly guy. I leave that for you to have fun with. I do these things on purpose so that you have to think about that history. But the Yalta Agreement has been maintained, portions of it, secret. So we don't know what else we're tied into with Russia or even England, as a matter of fact, from that agreement. But in the 50s, there was a senator from Ohio by the name of Bricker that was proposing an amendment that would stop and put a halt to the way that international agreements were being done. 1954, the Senate nearly passed. It was one vote away from passing a constitutional amendment to curtail the president's authority to make international agreements. 1954. But President Dwight D. Eisenhower avoided a major foreign policy loss thanks to an unusual ally. That was Lyndon Baines Johnson, who Eisenhower called upon to help defeat something that would have more protected our liberties. Amazing. It was amazing what occurred. Just to take this back a little bit further, before Eisenhower, you got to go back to Truman and what was going on. So first off, you had what was going on with Yalta and all of that. Harry Truman favored the strong executive. And in 52, his 1952 seizure, grasping, taking hold of U.S. steel mills, and his actions in Korea seemed to justify conservative apprehensions. In the latter case, Truman argued repeatedly that the United Nations Charter was a treaty he had the duty to execute, and whose authority obviated the need to consult Congress for a declaration of war. So if Truman could invoke the charter to justify a measure as serious as the deployment of American troops abroad, many conservatives wondered, what else would he do? What else could happen? So at that time, when they were looking at what was going on in the 40s and 50s, and then it was at that time that Franklin S. Holman, who laid the groundwork, and he was a real conservative in the American Bar Association, laid the ground with what would be called now the Bricker Amendment. And the Bricker Amendment was, in fact, to put parameters, parentheses, control mechanisms on this whole idea of the presidency just going out and doing exactly what Truman did. Now, this whole dispute actually goes back to about 1913, when Congress passed measures establishing federal regulations over the killing, capturing, or selling of birds. This was a dispute back then. The federal courts ruled the usurpation of rights reserved to the states under the 10th Amendment. So we're going back and trying to understand the depth of this. But what happened was, is that Eisenhower wanted this power. He wanted to be able to take and conduct foreign policy the way he wanted to without having the constraints of the Constitution or Congress. So it was a battlefront that went into play, especially in 1954. So what were the fears of the executive agreements, or everything that I was talking about relative that happened back in World War II? What's happening now and today? What's going on with the WHO changes to the constitution of the WHO that potentially sets up a World Health Organization? But one of the things I put in the newsletter, you have to understand, here's a caveat, is that there's a shall agree to or not agree to that is in there for countries to agree to or not agree to letting the UN do things. So it all depends on who we're going to have as president and who we're going to have as Congress, Senate, even the courts, because the courts play a big part in all of this. That's why I said I wish I had a lot of time to talk about this. I don't. And probably you get bored with me talking about it because, look, the real fact of the matter is I'm bringing this to you and what's going on. I'm talking to you about these truths. But what are you going to do with it? What can you do with it? That's a dilemma, isn't it? So let me get away. Let me just tell you that what you need to do is you need to go read these references for yourself. And the two that I'm on here right now with is from the Council of Foreign Relationships on TWE Remembers the Bricker Amendment, and it gets into a lot of these details, and then it gets into the details of the fact that Eisenhower goes and gets a hold of Lyndon Johnson to help him defeat, by one vote, defeat this amendment to the Constitution to control the power of the presidency in making international agreements. And then you have to remember that Biden received in 2020 all of the information and instructions on how to use it. But you don't know all that. Does it really matter in your life? Do you care? Or was the Super Bowl more important? Or now basketball or baseball? I sit here a little bit frustrated with my exuberance in asking the questions. And the reason of that being is that this information has been out there. And once again, you have not been informed by either our educational system. It has been removed out of the context of history, unless those are specific that are going to any higher education, being the corrupt university system, who are producing nothing but Congress. Or I said Congress? Communist. How about communist? That's what they're producing. Actually, they're producing international slaves, mindless minions to bow down to their ESG or DEI or environmentalism or all of the worship of everything except, as I said, I'd bring up, except of the God of our very foundation. So that's what's going on out there is what can you do about it? There's a lot of good clubs. There's a lot of good folks that are spending time and effort trying to look at, you know, how do we deal with all that is in front of us. Well, Sam Adams said a lot of it we have to deal with locally. We look at what's going on in Northeast Ohio, and the NOACA issue is the child of George Bush and Agenda 21 and is destructive to our liberties and our property. There's several people that are out there, as I've mentioned in other programs, that are fighting that, but not enough. The local politicians don't give a flying, you know, owl's ear about what's going on with that or the intent to do anything. When it comes down to local county government, even into your townships, your cities, who are the people that you elect? What are their backgrounds? And then who is it that they find as a final authority? That's the real question. That's a real question when we're taking and we're trying to develop candidates. All of this other stuff is informative. It's nice. It's even noise. When all the emotionalism that's going on out there, that's what people prefer to get caught up in. Remember the hurrahs of what? A satanic show on TV stuff, as well as even at a Super Bowl halftime, what is it that grabs your whole mind and soul that involves your spirit? Where is your allegiance? I may be talking to the choir here. But in the last minute, what is it that you can do? Biggest thing you can do is you can get your church to repent. If you really want to see a revival, it has to start with you and your local congregation. They need to understand that God is sovereign over everything. I've talked about sovereignty. It's not about our sovereignty as a nation. That's what everybody's ballyhooing about in relationship to this World Health Organization charter change. No, it's not just about our sovereignty as a nation. It's who is sovereign. And until we absolutely recognize that God is sovereign even over our leaders, and they recognize that they have to rule according to his sovereignty, well, then we deserve what we get. We got everything we've asked for. Sam Adams knew that. So did the anti-federalists. So we pray that you get your sovereignty set correctly. See you next week.